Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute past the hour, and we begin a new broadcast week, although perhaps not in the or not with the quality that I might otherwise prefer. I'm Bob Kincaid, and I've got a bug. No, no, not one of those NSA bugs. Some sort of viral or bacterial bug that's a respiratory nasty. Yeah. So there may be some even more pregnant than usual pauses this evening while I get hit by a coughing spasm. It's not fun, believe me. But apparently it's going around. I even heard from Jack at Shreveport, who said, yeah, that sounds like what I got. And then we later found out from our eldest daughter that she and grandbabies have it 90 miles away. So figure the vector on that one. I am Bob Kincaid. For good or ill, right now it feels like mostly ill. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. You're home for something we like to call conversation radio, to which you are welcome to contribute your ideas, your thoughts, by email, by phone call, by Skype, by participation in the chat room. Just about any way you can figure, short of standing outside on the back stoop and hollering. Although you're welcome to do that too. I just can't guarantee it'll get through the show. The Horn is, of course, available at headonradionetwork.com with our little old listen live button. And that's also where you go if you want to help make sure that The Horn stays on the air. Because of the long holiday weekend, we find ourselves playing a little bit of catch up here. But hopefully we'll be fine. And, cross your fingers. Thanks for the anonymous contribution over the weekend. No last name. Thank you very kindly. That means we need to raise about, say $270 this evening, so we can only have to worry about $150 tomorrow. And yes, oddly enough, I am still in the home studio, in case you're wondering. I had planned on being in Washington, D.C. for a few weeks. But feeling the way I do, I decided to take a powder on that. And I'll wait and maybe go next weekend if I've recovered. This is just icky. I haven't had a decent night's sleep in days. Feh. By the way, like I said, PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. So, too, is the traditional mail address. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, stands for Personal Mailbox, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V, 25801. And that's where you, if you prefer not to fool with PayPal, that's where you send contributions. If you're check or money order, remember, please don't make them payable to Bob Kincaid. Make them payable to The Horn or Head On Communications, as that makes it much easier to deposit into the bank account. So thank you, again, very kindly. Well, here we are, beginning of the week. I hope you all had a lovely Independence Day weekend. Ours was, we didn't do any running around or much. We spent time with friends and did some grilling and barbecuing and smoking. Pork shoulders, that is. Turned out to be delightful. I made some of the wonderful hot slaw and some of the killer tartar sauce that goes well with just about any fried meat. Mmm. And just had a generally relaxing time and then got it's like a sledgehammer between a ball peen hammer between the eyes with the upper respiratory. If I sound to you like I sound inside my head, it's probably better that I should just shut the mic off and go away. But I'm not going to do that. I don't know. See, that's the thing, Randy. I don't know if it's viral, bacterial, or what. Randy's saying, if it's viral, try some antiviral elderberry syrup, but check with your doctor first. I don't think I've ever done that. The elderberry syrup, not check with my doctor first. I can't check with my doctor first because I don't have a doctor. Even under the best of circumstances, here in the for-profit miracle healthcare miracle system, I get to see a physician's assistant or a certified nurse practitioner or something like that. Yeah. So, I mean, that's just the reality. So we'll see. We'll see. And, you know, that's only if I go on Cheap Doctor Tuesday that happens like once a month or something. Oh, the American healthcare system, isn't it? Isn't it just a wonder? It's a wonder anybody survives it. But no, I do know it's the beginning of the week. It's the 8th day of July. That means something around here. Yes. Oh, yes, it does. That's right, that's right. Step right up. It's Moran Monday on the horn. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Don't let the Morans get away. Right here behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas, you will hear right-wing Morans of the religious variety, the commercial variety, the capitalist variety, the mean variety, the ignorant variety. Morans, Morans, Morans. You can't tell the Morans without a program, and this here's the program that tells the Morans. You just can't tell them much. Upon entering the Moran Monday tent, do be careful and hang on to your wallets, your purses, your children, your valuables, and your sanity, because the Morans can get a mite grabby. Head for the hills, and you'll be up to your armpits in Morans. Oh, and I ain't kidding. We got lots of them. Two neck and neck, really, for the beginning of the program. Early on, I heard from our buddy Beth down in Texas. Oh my God! So they got this guy down there whose Twitter handle is at Gravatt, Gravatt, who is one of those rebranding communications advisors to the likes of Texas maximum governor, not for life, since he ain't going to run again, Rick Goodhair Perry. Rick Goodhair Perry has apparently decided it is time for him to mosey off into the sunset and, I don't know, spend his golden years there at Head Ranch. Oh, brother. But no, this Gravatt goober, that just sounds like something that happens to you. Eat the potato salad that sat too long in the sun at the 4th of July picnic. What's the matter? I got the Gravatts. Gravatt! Yeah. So, lo and behold, this Gravatt goober is dumber than a bag of hammer handles. Not hammers, the handles. They're even dumber than the hammers. Because he has apparently declared that he went and found himself the Centers for Disease Control website. He started into reading. Of course, you know when he was doing it, him being a moron and all, his finger was running under the words, and his mouth was a moving at the same time. Look, Ma! I'm a reading. And in not so closely reading the CDC statistics, he declared that there are more, and well, this is a quote. Waiting for it to populate here now. There we go. abortion kills more Americans than heart disease. See what he did there? He's declaring that an unborn fetus is a merkin. Yeah, only not. Man, when you're out of the gates with a moron like that, well, you're going to be busy. It ain't going to get any easier. A little tiny wad of tissue hooked in to the uterine wall of a woman in America is as American as, oh, I don't know, George Washington or Martin Luther King or Susan B. Anthony or you or me. Mm-hmm. So that's where those goobs are. Heart disease don't kill as many Americans as abortion do. So, Ryan, grab it. Private, grab it. Ryan, grab it. You are our first nominee for Moran Monday. I mean, they's stupid, and then they's stupid. Yeah, what a maroon. So, that. But let us move along, because this nomination comes in, and I suspect that Dr. John didn't say so directly, but I suspect he saw a tweet of mine that I noted at 6:04 a.m. this morning. The a.m. part sort of gives away the this morning part, doesn't it? 6:04 a.m., I was up coughing my fool head off and just happened to flick on the TV. Yeah, you know what was on. Morning Joe. Because we want to make sure that my blood pressure medicine's really working. And there's some prattling idiot talking about the Asiana Airlines crash that happened over the weekend. And let's see. It was declared in this little package, the little talker regarding the Asiana Airlines crash at SFO, that it was, and I quote, a miracle that so many people survived the crash. A miracle. My thoughts, of course, immediately turned to the two young 16-year-old Chinese girls who didn't get to buy in on the miracle, and one of whom was apparently run over by an emergency response vehicle. What was that bump, Fred? I think that was people. Damn. So, yeah. There's that. So in response, I got this note for Moran Monday from Dr. John. Subject line for this Moran Monday: disasters, miracles, end quote, and the media. Bob, and you know, in addition to being a brilliant professor, Dr. John also has a career dedicated to actual journalism, and I could sort of feel the frustration rays coming off the screen as I read this. Bob, can we get a movement going to permanently ban the use of the word miracle in reporting about disasters, both natural and man-made? This has galled me ever since I was a little bitty copy editor, and now I think I have the language to express why it's a problem. And see, that's the thing about us on this side. We actually try to figure out what it is that's kind of giving us that itch that we can't reach to scratch, and then we don't necessarily just go running off at the mouth until we've got what Dr. John calls the language to express why it's a problem. Dr. John continues, most recently, I'm seeing this in reference to the airline crash at San Francisco on Saturday. It's, quote, a miracle, unquote, that more people weren't killed, so the story goes. This is a real problem, considering at least two people did, in fact, die. If we take miracle in its literal sense of a wondrous work of God, and that's what miracle means, from the Latin miraculum via Old French, then you have to ask which is more wondrous, that God spared so many, or that two people, two 16-year-old girls, didn't make the cut. That sounds terrible to say, but damn it, I'm not the one using that language in the first place. Remember the Kew Creek mine flood that trapped nine miners in Pennsylvania? CNN dubbed their rescue as a minor miracle. Oh, you see what they did there? As Dr. John notes, how cute. That's M-I-N-E-R, miracle. Get it? How cute. And the one that really gets me is the so-called Miracle on the Hudson. You remember that, U.S. Airways Flight 1549, an Airbus A320 that ditched in the river minutes after takeoff from LaGuardia. What a miracle! No, that was no miracle. That was a clear demonstration of what careful engineering and highly trained union pilots and flight crews can accomplish under the right conditions. That's my problem with the use of the word miracle. When we call a disaster with survivors a miracle, we remove any blame from the perpetrators and any credit from the deserving. Everything's placed in God's hands. Or rather, the good parts are God's doing, and the bad parts are conveniently forgotten. Well, Dr. John, can't we also say that the bad parts are chalked up to Satan? Sure we can. Because we do. The Asiana crash was a miracle. So we don't need to think about how the pilot had just 40 hours of experience flying Boeing 777s. And we certainly don't need to ask why flight hours aren't more tightly regulated. And we don't need to ask why a corporation can allow lightly trained pilots and flight crews in airliners with hundreds of people aboard. Because then we might start asking why shareholder profit trumps human life. And that might lead us to look harder at fracking. Or, say, mountaintop removal coal extraction. No, it's all just safe and comfortable miracles. Nothing at all to do with human achievement and collective action, or on the other side, greed and profit and externalities. That's so elegantly put, so concisely explained, because at 6:04 a.m. today, when I heard, it's a miracle, well, Agnes was still asleep. And bless her heart, she comes awake quick if I so much as make a passing, you know, more than minuscule noise. So she popped up out of bed like there was a spring underneath her head when I went, "Oh! What's the matter, baby?" "Oh, nothing, dear. Nothing. Just another miracle." To which she replied, "Turn that damned thing off and come back to sleep." Which turned out to be really, really good advice. And I did, in between spasms of hacking and coughing. Oh, well. At least we got this nomination in. It would appear that we are off the air. So that's massively frustrating. And especially in light of the fact that just a few minutes ago, Randy got us started on the evening saying, "I have to admire your fortitude." coming to work sick and all. Thank you. Thank you, Mandy. You took us down to $245 to go this evening, which we may never reach in light of what's happened here. This is one of those pauses I was telling you about. Well, my sincere apologies. It's kind of strange. We've had trouble connecting to the server, apparently. Stand by, please. Well, at any rate, I'm going to try to get us back. We still get internet connectivity here. I'll check something. Yeah. So something funny is going on at the servers. And the White Rose site is down. So if we can get this thing going again, we will continue. Stand by. All right, at 6 minutes past the hour of 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, we are back to the air. It turns out the... Well, no, wait. I got an email here. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is More and Monday on the Horn. We've been away for no small amount of time. And, right as things were going south, based on our previous conversation of the use of the word miracle to describe the people who survived the Asiana Airlines crash, but the two 16-year-old human beings who didn't get in on the miracle. I got a note in from Tamara. Tamara said, "Boy, do I share your frustration of the miracle talk these days. Don't recall what brand of God is good it was, but I happened to see a homeless dude without legs the other day wearing a T-shirt with some kind of Christian miracle message, and I couldn't help but think of that example of how God is good to all them amputees of faith. Also had to wonder if the shirt wearer actually purchased the tee, doubtful, or if it was an example of some good old Christian charity, clothing the naked in inspirational messages. Or, as I like to call it, Tamara, advertising. Now I'm not doing so well myself," she says. "Uh-huh. Signed, Tamara, in Vacation Land, USA. God is good." So, yeah, hey, look! The Horn's back on the air at 8 minutes past 7 p.m. It's a miracle! But in all truth, Tamara's note put me in mind of this.
This old man and me were at the bar and we were having us some beers and swapping out on cares, talking politics, blonde and redhead chicks, old dogs and new tricks and habits we ain't kicked. We talked about God's grace and all the hell we raised. Then I heard the old man say, God is great, beer is good, and people are crazy. He said, I fought two wars, been married and divorced. What brings you to Ohio? He said, damn if I know. We talked an hour or two about every girl we knew, what all we put them through, like two old boys will do. We pondered life and death, he lit a cigarette, said these damn things will kill me, yeah. But God is great, beer is good, people are crazy. Last call is 2 a.m. I said goodbye to him. I never talked to him again. Then one sunny day, I saw the old man's face. Front page obituary, he was a millionaire. He left his fortune to some guy he barely knew. His kids were mad as hell, but me, I'm doing well. And I drop by today to just say thanks and pray. And I left a six pack right there on his grave. And I said, God is great, beer is good, people are crazy. God is great, beer is good, people are crazy. God is great, beer is good, people are crazy.
Now, before the emails start, I didn't play that song because I like it. I played that song because... That's Billy Currington, by the way. The name of the song is People Are Crazy. I played that song because it kind of fits in, doesn't it, with the overall theme of we like it and we call it a miracle when, you know, several hundred people survive, and we just sort of overlook the two dead teenagers on the tarmac. And we get to, thanks to the long moran heritage of this country and its sick, sordid fascination with Calvinism and Nouveau Calvinism and Calvinism 2.0 and Turbo Calvinism, and which all says if I'm flush, God likes me. I mean, even my personal hero, Mark Twain, Mr. Clemens, as I like to call him, recognized this way back when he wrote the war prayer. When you pray for rain on your crops, you pray for destitution on someone else's. By default. Miracles. But did you notice how it got to be such an upbeat song? I mean, you know, there was the old man, and they were talking about God being good and gracious and getting liquored up. and claiming that people are crazy. But it turns into a happy song when the guy gives his millions, Calvinism again, morons, gives his millions to the guy singing the song, who is then able to go off and play guitar and live on a little island somewhere. See how it all works? There's actually a long heritage of songs out there. I was talking to Ferg about this the other day. There's a long heritage of songs out there about guys who get in, people who get in conversations with guys that people who turn out not to really be there. Let's see. This one comes to mind. Let's try this.
I went down to Captain Tony's to get out of the heat. When I heard a voice call out to me, "Son, come have a seat." I had to search my memory as I looked into those eyes. My life's changed like the weather, but a legend never dies. He said, "I ate the last tango in Paris, took the last plane out of Saigon, took the first fast boat to China, and Jimmy, there's still so much to be done." I had a third world girl in Buzios with a pistol in each hand. She always kept me covered as we moved from land to land. I had a damn good run on Wall Street with my high fashion model wife. I woke up dry beneath the African sky, just me and my Swiss Army knife. I ate the last tango in Paris, took the last plane out of Saigon, took the first fast boat to China, and Jimmy, there's still so much to be done. We shot the breeze for hours as the sun fell from the skies. Like the sun, he disappeared before my very eyes. It was somewhere past dark 30, and I went back to the head. I read upon the dingy wall the words the old man said. I am the last man going.
But you get the idea, right? That there are just mystical things out there that we don't understand. And sometimes old men sitting on bar stools are the one. And I mean, it goes back. I mean, there's all kinds of human traditions of strange travelers in the night. I was explaining to Ferg the other night about the Mashika god Hekatl, the night wind, who would occasionally visit. Who knows why people are this way? But apparently, it is deep-seated in us one way or the other. And when something good happens to us, well, it's a miracle. And when something bad happens to us, no, the sky spook doesn't get blamed for that. So the sky spook gets credit on this Morin Monday for saving 300 or so human beings. But the sky spook is not called to account for the two 16-year-old girls lying dead on the runway. Got it. I don't know. Maybe the answer on this Morin Monday, maybe the answer is to fit all for-profit media reporters with shock collars. And if they say miracle, just take care of it pretty quick, wouldn't it? I can think of other places where that would come in handy, too. Like when, a few months back when a couple of the CNN types waxed rhapsodically and fearfully and sadly over the tragic fates of the little rapists in Steubenville and what was going to become of their lives. Right. Yeah, you get the idea. Yeah, that's true. That's true, Stockton. Yeah. Or crashing the plane, too, for that matter, too, also. Yes, absolutely. So, like I said, we've got some stuff to work with this evening, and we've got a trip to the mailbag. This coming in just before showtime, just before time for the program. See, shock collar for Bob. Show. This ain't no show. There's no puppets. There are no sword swallowers or fire eaters or... I mean, they're inside the Moran Monday tent, right? Ron and Raleigh sent this in just before the program started. Hey, Bob, I'm sure you're aware of the law that was put into place by felon-in-chief of Florida. We'd like to call him an unindicted co-conspirator, Rick Voldemort Scott, that required anyone seeking public assistance to be drug-tested. After the program was evaluated, it was found that testing had a 2% hit rate. The state of Florida rescinded the law, noting that the cost was not justified by the puny number of hits. Now, that's the state of Florida with a massive, for instance, climate change-denying, ultra-right-wing, more or less Confederate legislature. They ditched it themselves. Well, guess what, Ron asked. Guess what kind of law is being studied in North Carolina? That's right. A lot of drug test people seeking public assistance. Repiglicans are the most moronic people on earth. I'm starting to have a cold knot in the pit of my stomach concerning the Trayvon Martin murder case. I believe the state of Florida is looking for any way they can to let George Zimmerman off the hook. Yeah, did you see that thing the other day? Zimmerman says that after he's acquitted, he's going to go to work for Fox. And I wouldn't be surprised if a job's already been offered. They're trying to justify the Stand Your Ground law. Oh, dear God, there's a link. Check out the link so you can know that we're living in a post-racial America. And you know how to spell America in that case. A-M-E-R-I-K-K-K-A. Oh, how nice. From Wonkett. 4th of July parade, Confederate watermelon display. Absolutely not racist. Not one little bit. Posted earlier today over at Wonkett. Wonkett.com. Hope Mills, North Carolina. A big old John Deere tractor. Pulling a rather obvious John Deere wagon, you know, painted green and yellow. The tractor festooned, and the, you know, 6 foot high tires, the worst. The tractor festooned with a Confederate battle flag, pulling a wagon of watermelons with the sign on it, on the 4th of July, White History Month. No, White History Month. The copy that goes with the story from Wonkett. Town officials in Hope Mills, North Carolina, are fielding calls from irate residents after the town's 4th of July parade featured an antique farm tractor flying a Confederate battle flag and towing a watermelon-filled trailer with a sign reading, White History Month, Hug White People. Hug W-T-E-P-P-L. For some reason, the callers said they thought the display might be racist. Town officials are considering instituting, they haven't done it, they're thinking about it. Instituting tighter rules on parade entry applications, possibly including a line about no racist bullshit allowed, and don't pretend your dog whistle bullshit isn't racist, you moron. The tractor and trailer were among 8 antique vehicles entered in the parade by Donnie Spell, who has participated in town parades for years. Hope Mills Parks and Recreation Department head Kenny Bullock also said that he had asked a member of Spell's family to take the signs down before the parade started, and only learned they were still on the trailer when people started calling his cell phone to complain during the parade. Well, if you can't put White History Month Hug White People on your wagon, what the hell good is the 4th of July anyway? I mean, the Declaration of Independence was written by white people, weren't it? Well, it sure were. Town officials told Durham TV station WTVD that Spell's application for the parade entry said only that he would be pulling an antique tractor with a sign that read, "Watermelons for Sale." Oh, so he's a liar. The TV station also spoke to a neighbor of Spell's who said he didn't think the man was a trying to be vicious or funny, because that's the sort of stupid thing neighbors say to cover their friends, obviously race-bait nasties. I'm liking this writer at Wonkette. Kenny Bullock, who never learned the first law of holes, when you're in one, quit digging, added, I feel like there's a time and a place for everything. Was the parade the place? I don't think so. So, when is the time and the place for your antique tractor and your the cart filled with watermelons with the sign that says, White History Month, Hug White People? Good God. But see, that's what happens when you let political correctness get a hold of your country. Then people start criticizing you for flying your Confederate battle flag, pulling your trailer load of watermelons. By God, Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and Ben Franklin all loved they some watermelons. Hug white people. And you know, there's more of the same. What was his name? Adam Koresh, Adam versus the man keeping Adam down. Kokesh, Adam Kokesh. Sorry, I confused those two. Well, guess what? Turns out that on the 4th of July, he didn't have him no march through Washington, D.C., because he canceled that quick as they found out that he might be starting a little problem, like war. So instead, he went to Freedom Plaza. I know exactly where it is in Washington, D.C., and he made himself a YouTube video. Everybody doing that these days. Mm-hmm. Well, let's see what Adam Kokesh had to say.
Be silent. We will not obey. We will not.
Oh, I faded up on him. I don't want him getting cheated out of any of his free speech.
We will not be silent. We will not obey. We will not allow our government to destroy our humanity. We are the final American Revolution. See you next Independence Day.
Yeah, hopefully we'll be seeing you in prison, Adam. And just imagine, this is those little sound effects. I mean, I was watching the video, so I can tell you. Those little sound effects, those little clicks and clacks, those were real live, honest to God shotgun shells being pushed into the receiver of a short-barreled pump-action, what appears to be 12-gauge shotgun. And then the is him pulling the lever down, pump the pump down, and then the is him loading one of the shells into the chamber to ready it for firing. Freedom Plaza is just down the street from the White House, by the way. And I just want to point something out. This is the crowd that pushes the Eddie Snowden is a national hero meme. More on that in a minute. We are the final American Revolution. See you next Independence Day. Atne Ute Aitbre is Adam Okesh K. Meanwhile, he put it up on YouTube, and the proper authorities are reviewing it to see if perhaps Mr. Kokesh ought to be taken into custody for apparently loading and chambering around in a shotgun in the middle of a city where, by law, expressed as a function of the will of the people, you can't go swanning around with a loaded shotgun. It's just not legal. I'm crazy. I'm a rule of law guy. I don't like anarchy. I don't much care for chaos. That's okay. This is the same crowd that thinks Rand Paul is a patriotic hero of the people. Huh! So, just in case you were wondering. We have many. In the Father's house are many Morans. Right? So there's that. Now, I said more on that a minute ago, and I want to clear something up. I am doing my dead level best not to talk about Eddie Snowden. What happens to him happens. He made a bed, he's laying. But to the extent that you guys want to talk about it, I do. And I got a note from Patrick in Germany. Read it this morning. He says, I just heard your conversation with Sandra, which happened last week, talking about metadata. I find your reasoning painfully flawed, says Patrick. When I put the address of the recipient on the envelope, I am not waiving my privacy rights. I know that only a handful of people will be reading the information, using it to deliver the letter. This fact is no justification for the government to collect and compile a list of all letters and addresses I ever wrote and sent in my life. I am shocked that you are hell-bent to find ways to defend the government's spying. Why? Can we agree that government is supposed to have the interests of the people in mind, but in fact, currently and for a long time, only act on the interests of the power structure? For me personally, Snowden is a true hero, and I currently wish for nothing more than for Germany to grant him asylum. But it will never happen because then we would have to deal with the outpouring of hatred from your country, you know, the old Europe. Remember when the Bush crowd called old Europe? Right. Kind regards, St. Patrick. So let's see if we can square this up real quick. What I described and what Patrick thinks is painfully flawed reasoning may be, but it is not my reasoning. It is the reasoning of the Supreme Court of the United States more than a generation ago, which means that it is part of a body of judicially interpreted law that is referred to as the common law, and it stands as precedent to future rulings. This is the nature of the legal system. Judges interpret, the legislative body makes a law, the judges interpret the law in the light of the Constitution as to what is and is not constitutional. And so, way back, looking at the issue of the mails, in the context of trying to determine whether or not it would be constitutional for you know, law enforcement to pursue what were called pen registers, P-E-N-R-E-G-I-S-T-E-R-S, which were basically the records of calls made, not the content of the call, you know, not meet me in the middle of the bridge, I'll bring the briefcase full of money, you bring the guy's head in a bowling ball bag. Not the content. Merely who dialed whom, when, that kind of stuff. It's called metadata. So, the Supreme Court, looking at that request, in other words, was it constitutional for a law enforcement agency to go and get a search warrant to seize these pen registers? I think I'm describing the situation. I don't have the case right in front of me, but we're within the ballpark. The Supreme Court said, you, a person, has no privacy interest, because there are various shades and grades of privacy interests, from very high expectations of privacy to no expectation of privacy whatsoever in modern life. Now, back when this case was being decided, it was either you either dial the phone by pushing buttons or by turning a rotor. I think this is in post the era of Sarah, get me Sheriff Taylor. This is after that. So my painfully flawed reasoning is actually the reasoning of the Supreme Court of the United States, and we're not talking about the rats. We're talking about something that happened 45 years ago. Was it Smith versus Maryland or something? In which the court said, look, if you place a call, you want the call to go through. You have no expectation of privacy in the number you're dialing, simply because you've already turned over the number to the phone company in order for the phone company to be able to connect your call. You've waived your privacy right in that. And in reaching that decision, they said, listen, if you create a piece of mail and you put to John Smith and put John Smith's address on it, and up the upper left-hand corner, you put from Tom Jones and Tom Jones's address. In order for that piece of mail to be delivered, an agent of the government, remember, the United States Postal Service is a government, well, at one point in time, Postmaster General was a cabinet-level position. But the Supreme Court reasoned that not only do you expect the address on the outside of the envelope to not be private, you actually want people to read it so that they can get your mail from point A to point B, from sender to addressee. And therefore, you have waived an expectation of privacy in that address data, which is, again, metadata. I would think that would be simple, but it is apparently not. In point of fact, the Postal Service long ago quit using human beings to read every envelope. I mean, good God, look at the letters to Santa Claus scene from Miracle on whichever street it was. You know, the little Natalie Wood, Maureen O'Hara, right. There's a scene where bags of mail are being sorted. Well, we have machines to do that now. The machines are actually run by computers. The computers read the mail. They don't read the contents of the mail. They read the external part of the mail. Perhaps they read barcodes. There's not a human being out there who can read a barcode. Only computers can do that. Of course, I'm probably wrong. But suffice to say, the United States Postal Service does not have a bunch of people who sit around reading barcodes. They let computers do it. In order to have the computers be right, there has to be a database of barcode information. Now, is this some creeping assault on our freedom? Or is it an attempt to get the mail from point A to point B as efficiently as possible? You know, back when I used the phrase snail mail to describe folks who wanted to contribute to the horn that way, I stopped using that phrase when I got upbraided for it by saying, well, there's a lot of good union workers who work for the Postal Service. Well, are they freedom destroyers? Because in the mindset of, well, yeah, they are. They're stealing all our freedoms by getting the mail rather efficiently from point A to point B. This is a data-intensive society. I don't much appreciate being told that I am hell-bent to find ways to defend the government spying, because that's not what I'm doing. I am, however, trying to live in reality world, instead of, for instance, a world in which it's a miracle when 300 people survive an airplane crash, but we'll just leave the two people who burned up on the tarmac, little 16-year-old girls, and say that God didn't have a hand in that, too. I live in reality world. And the reality is God didn't have a blessed thing to do with either living or dying on the tarmac at SFO. And describing a process and understanding what the reality of the process is and understanding the reality that the Supreme Court declares what is and is not constitutional, going all the way back to Marbury versus Madison, is not being hell-bent to find ways to defend the government's spying. Patrick does ask, can we agree that government is supposed to have the interests of the people in mind? Actually, no. Because government is supposed to be the people, at least in the United States, because that's why our Constitution begins, we the people of the United States, you know, in order to form a blah, blah, you get it. The government is the people. Now, necessarily, the people should have the best interests of people in mind. And while I have never spent a moment of my life afraid of a terrorist, not even a millisecond, all those years that Osama bin Laden was running free, I never, never, never once woke up in a sweat wondering if some 6'6" Arab with a portable dialysis machine was going to reduce my local Walmart to a pile of smoking rubble the next day. It is far more likely that some libertarian will pull out his shooting gun and start to defend in freedom over on Action Alley in Walmart. But the fact of the matter is, the findings that surround all of this are predicated upon the interests of the people. The interests of the people not to be rendered into charred heaps by someone who apparently doesn't think much one way or the other of setting off a device or a belt or whatever. Because the American people are scared. The American people are terrified. The American people are, in a word, terrorized. And as that Book of Myths put it, after September 11, 2001, they cried, "Lord, Lord." And it just happened to be George W. Bush who said, "I'm right here. I'm right here." And that's when this extra governmental program was put in place. It was put in place without anyone's knowledge. It was developed by the corporate side of the the industrial side of the military-industrial complex, at the request of some people who had no regard for the Constitution. And it was put in place not because they were just sitting there. Well, I don't. Who knows what they want to do with the data? But the covert reason expressed was to be able to stop terrorist attacks before they begin. And this is the era of Donald Rumsfeld and his known knowns and his unknown knowns and his garden gnomes and his, you know, right. The Rumsfeld and the Cheneys and the Bushes of the world, having already been caught with their pants down and planes flying into buildings on September 11th, 2001, when they had ignored the very warnings that that was going to happen, suddenly decided it might be a good idea if they didn't get caught twice. And so they put in place a data collection process that the New York Times found out about and then sat on through an election in 2004. Even me, Mr. Doesn't Do Math on the Fly very well, knows that that was 9 years ago. But which was eventually subjected to some sort of legislative process. Remember the legislative branch that makes the laws and the Supreme Court that interprets? Right. And whether the legislation was good or bad is a separate inquiry from whether the legislation was properly passed, according to Hoyle, if you will. Incidentally, along the lines of this, Ars Technica. Remember, all this data that's being collected by this third-party contractor, this industrial part of the military-industrial complex, working on behalf of the government at exorbitant rates paid for by you, the taxpayer, we, the people. Remember, all this data was collected, again, from private corporations, just as the pen records were collected from the phone company. It is deeply disturbing. I don't even like admitting that I live in a country where apparently a significant percentage of the people therein walk around halfway filling their underwear with fear that, you know, some Islamist is gonna get their Walmart. But for the love of God, if you want to blame somebody for that, there's somebody to blame. There are cable news channels that run 24/7 trying to make sure that the American people are kept in a state of constant fear. Bone-bending, water-boweling fear. And not necessarily as a result of some action or inaction on the part of the Negro of Doom. Jeez, I'm sick of this. So no, it's not my flawed reasoning, and I'm not hell-bent to defend anything. But I absolutely do insist. Not that you. I don't insist that you, any of us, I don't insist that anyone but I live in a reality-based world. for instance, like I was alluding a minute ago, Ars Technica website. Yeah, they hosted what was called an internet relay chat. Back in 2009, Eddie Snowden apparently got on one and gave up all kinds of metadata so that he could be subsequently identified as being Eddie Snowden, and said that leakers should be, and I quote, shot in the balls. Now, this was shortly after Barack Obama came to office, but he was referring to the people who gave up the same domestic spying program that he would go on to elaborate on 4 years later. Shot in the balls. See, a leaker needs to be shot in the balls when they've leaked something about, you know, the former president's administration. But a leaker becomes a world global hero when he acquires information and releases it to the whomever, South China Post, or to a blogger living in Brazil, or the Washington Post, whomever. He becomes a hero as long as he's dropping the dime on the Negro of Doom. And frankly, I'm not going to tumble for it. Just not. I'm going to tell you what you should or should not think, but I'm not. All the drama that surrounds Edward Snowden's, I don't know, his current whereabouts or whyabouts or whatabouts. It tells me one thing. It tells me that the number of people who know anything whatsoever about American history is surprisingly small. I was talking with Dr. Bill about this the other day. The hunting of Edward Snowden? Oh, please. You want to talk about somebody who got hunted? I got a story for you. And it makes the Snowden story look like a walk in the park. It concerns a fellow who had allegedly what were thought to be urges to start a new country. And who dabbled in the military secrets of the young United States. When what were perceived to be his transgressions were found out, the President of the United States used every bit of the power of his office to hunt him down, bring him to trial, and then, really, no kidding, tried to use personal influence to secure a conviction on a charge, a capital charge. In a time when a capital charge, nobody batted an eyelash at the subsequent hanging or firing squad of treason. The man was the third Vice President of the United States His name was Aaron Burr. The president who tried to hunt him down and displayed a most unpresidential animus and a most unseemly regard for his rights was the same man who wrote the words that we celebrated this past weekend. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That president was Thomas Jefferson. Aaron Burr was brought to trial before the United States Circuit Court at Richmond, Virginia. The Jefferson administration had him arraigned four separate times on a charge of treason before a grand jury would bite and indict. And even that charge of treason did not fit within the constitutional definition of treason. Oh, there was a lot of stuff that came to light, or began coming to light, that would not be subsequently confirmed for some number of years. It turned out that the number one general in the western United States, after the Louisiana Purchase, headquartered at New Orleans, a man named Wilkinson, really was a spy. He was getting a payday from the Crown of Spain every month. And in a trice, he would have been willing to sell his country out. But Aaron Burr was hounded. And when Aaron Burr was acquitted of treason, it is said that Thomas Jefferson was furious. Thomas Jefferson even challenged the right of the Supreme Court of the United States under Chief Justice John Marshall, who was a cousin of his and whom Jefferson despised, to have anything to do with the case. It is one of the most fascinating periods in American history, and one of the most fascinating stories. Of course, there is a West Virginia tie-in. There was no West Virginia at the time, but there's a little island in the Ohio River off from what is now Parkersburg, West Virginia, that is called Blennerhassett Island. And it was at Blennerhassett Island and the mansion thereon that much of the circumstantial evidence claiming treason was said to have been planned. Burr, the one thing that we can prove was that Burr had leased 40,000 acres along the Ouachita River in what is now Louisiana from the Crown of Spain. That was outside the boundaries of the Louisiana Purchase. There was plenty of intrigue going on. Very little of it had to do with Burr. The anti-American spy who would have sold his own country out in a minute and gone to live in some Spanish-speaking land. General James Wilkinson agitated most loudly against Burr when the balloon went up in order to provide cover for himself and his own very real anti-American impulses. Some have found, and this is fascinating, some have found that the actual motive of Aaron Burr was, in fact, warfare. But it wasn't warfare against the United States. He saw the rule of the Spanish over the people of what we now know as Mexico, that it then included part of Texas, that included all of Texas, to be odious. And he actually hoped to help the Mexican people overthrow the Spaniards in the Southwest. Of course, he thought it might just be possible that he would wind up being the king or some sort of political head of any such revolutionary government. After all, he had been centrally involved in the American Revolution not too awfully many years before. Isn't that fascinating? There really was a case where a man was hounded and sought and fled for his very life under BS charges of treason. It has happened in this country. Burr wound up, after being indicted, going to live abroad in Europe in an attempt to rehabilitate his finances. He wound up being one of the very last revolutionary Americans remaining. He died in 1836 in Port Richmond on Staten Island in New York. So the next time somebody tells you that Obama is shredding the Constitution, oh my God! Tell them that if he's shredding it, he's only making littler pieces of it. Because the first shreddings took place when the ink itself was hardly. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's John. How you doing?
Hey, John.
A lot of good stuff tonight. I missed the first part in the long break, but just a couple things. I wanted to let folks know, first of all, a reminder that Gasland Part 2 is premiering tonight on HBO.
Wonderful.
And I know that's kind of a tiny little garden, but, you know, some folks probably have access to it, so I really encourage them to see it. I saw it here in Binghamton, and it's terrific. It's well worth your time, and hopefully, maybe tomorrow some clips will start showing up that's more accessible to folks for sharing and watching and that sort of thing.
Excellent, excellent. I hope I'll go looking around tomorrow and see if, yeah, maybe the occasional clip has come out. I probably need to get I probably need to make the actual effort to get Josh Fox on the program.
Well, that would really be something. I think he did this sort of grassroots screening tour. So, I mean, he's certainly open to the ideas we make in the rounds, the media rounds. So, I mean, it would be a very interesting discussion, I think, if you could. I know that's difficult to do, but, hit me up off air if you want some help trying to organize that. You know, I've got nothing but time these days.
Okay.
some good stuff, and I don't know if you want to, you know, go any further on the Snowden thing. I had some thoughts.
But, oh no, go ahead. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. I guess my main thing is, and this is sort of undeveloped, but it seems like another issue of dealing with a symptom and not a root cause. And the symptoms are really deep. I mean, you talked about the institution of the FISA court, and that's a bigger problem than this program. But what underlies that is the war on terror. And what underlies that, more or less directly, is the September 11th attacks. And what underlies that, despite what right-wingers say, is American expansionism. And what underlies that is capital. I mean, it just seems like we're so tempted to pluck the mushroom when that's the most visible thing, it's the shiny object, but the real root of the problem is hidden and it's buried and it's something that spreads around and affects everybody. Does that make any sense?
It makes an abundance of sense. I mean, you laid out a few layers there. This is a giant stinking onion that we're peeling through whose layers we are peeling. And the idea of a war on terror, just linguistically, because I know linguistics matters to you, Dr. John.
Sure.
The war on, you can't have a war on terror without first having had a war on drugs. And, of course, a tremendous degree of this surveillance state stuff does not necessarily have its roots. Well, I mean, after September 11th terrorism in the 90s, sure. But before that, it's drugs. Most of the case law that involves the real shredding of the Fourth Amendment, you know, not this, oh my God, breathless BS that we've been listening to for the last month or so. The real shredding of the Constitution took place as a result of the war on drugs. Nelson Rockefeller started the war on drugs in New York State in the early mid-70s. And it quickly spiraled out of control, and it has now resulted in the prison industrial complex. It has resulted in the incarceration of young males of color at rates that are wildly disproportionate to young white males, and it's not because young white males behave any better. I can guarantee you that.
Indeed.
So much of this surveillance state stuff was about, you know, trying to find out who had a quarter pound of weed in their in their suitcase and you know, getting that guy to prison.
Man, I'm so glad you said that. I think that that's absolutely true. And this is sort of my other reaction to this is that this seems like a lot of outrage based on privilege. And I'm wondering,
yes,
where all these people that are so upset about their Google searches and their, you know, damn Facebooking being surveilled. I wonder if they're aware that less affluent people of color in cities are constantly being surveilled.
What did Michael Bloomberg say the other day, Dr. John? He said we're not. Didn't he say that we aren't stopping and frisking enough people of color in New York City? Didn't he say that?
Yeah, I did see that. Yeah, exactly. So I mean, I know this is a broad brush. I mean, to say where are these people? There are certainly people that are ringing that bell. Like there are people that protested, you know, the war in protest American capital expansion. But it seems so much of this outrage is very, very selective, and because it's now a problem for affluent white folks, that now this is going to get all over the news. And maybe that's a provocative thing to say, but there's an old saying in newspapers, and I'm sure you're aware of this, you know, it's not a story until the editor's affected by it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, and that's, I cannot shake this feeling, and it's not to say that there's anything good about this work, but it's been happening, and the roots of it are not Obama, and it's not the NSA, because they've been doing this forever. And there are so much more significant existential threats to our freedom than government surveillance. Really basic things about our daily lives, you know, air quality and water quality and the way that we equate freedom with the ability to overconsume. That's a real threat, and that's the kind of thing that we can't seem to get much traction on.
And the thing that I go back to my previous statement, Dr. John, and that is this, that the American people really are, I mean, it's been successful, whether you're the people who fly planes into buildings or whether you're the people who are trying to prevent people from flying planes into buildings. Both sides have been equally successful in just absolutely scaring the bejesus out of the American people.
Right.
And we are a people motivated by fear. And you know what? A people motivated by fear are no longer a people one can consider to be a free people.
No, that's not freedom in the same way that being able to choose between 25 different breakfast cereals doesn't equal freedom. You know, but that's the very simplistic sort of dialogue we have. You know, and this is a real existential and structural problem that is difficult to organize people to address or even think about in the face of a problem, but not, you know, not a personality story, which is what this is becoming. I mean, if the guy was such a hero, why didn't he, you know, I hate myself for even saying this, but why didn't he, you know, take his lumps and go to trial and then put the program on trial? I mean, that, you know, I read that somewhere. It seems like a reason.
And, you know, I'm more sympathetic than I might otherwise be to the claim that in this day and age, it would probably be tried by a secret court.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? Whether that is true, and I suspect it to be true, that's a flagrant violation of constitutional principles of open access to the courts and the right of a defendant to confront his accuser. And it goes way back. It goes way back. But yeah. But you know, A, we're afraid, and B, as we have lamented in the past, Dr. John, what we know of our civic structure can be put in a thimble and have room left for a nice double shot of espresso with some half-calf latte foam on top of it.
Well, yeah, our civil structure, and I mean, I would even say that, you know, the economic structure is what underlies and allows that to happen, and the roots of, or the effects of capital and exploitation are so wide-ranging. I mean, they touch so many things. They touch this FISA thing. They touch the war on terror thing. They touch environmental degradation. They touch so many things that you don't even expect. I mean, for instance, did you see that we lost the Western black rhino? It's extinct. It's gone.
I knew that. No, I didn't. Damn.
Yeah, they announced it today. It's official. There's no more. You know, Okay, so who cares about rhinos, whatever, you know, it's a species gone extinct. It's a species that went extinct because of capitalism, because there's a poaching trade, and because economic destabilization in West African countries creates a need for people to get money by poaching to subsist, when humans don't need money to subsist throughout our history.
In other words, prior to capitalism's arrival in Africa...
Right.
There were not bands of hunter-gatherers who were sharpening up their spear points to go black rhino hunting.
Oh, there probably certainly were, and they took some, but they took a number that was sustainable because their group size was sustainable, and there was no need to accumulate giant mountains of rhino horn to sell to another country. Because
can we equate this with what happened to the buffalo in the 19th century in the American West?
Absolutely. Indiscriminate hunting. It wasn't because we needed buffalo hides. I mean, we used them for things, of course, but it was designed to destroy a food source that the native people depended on. You know, it's racism. There's an economic component to it, of course, but that is economic warfare, and that's happening every day. And I just can't get past the idea that that is a real threat to all of our well-being. And this kind of national security theater is not, or it's not. not nearly, like, we can tackle that once we tackle the fact that we are dooming ourselves with our consumption and our the social structure that's enabled by capitalism.
But the way you lay it out, John, it's inescapable. Why is this conversation not being framed in these terms?
Well, we're, you know, and Dr. Bill talked about this. We're taught not to believe in that. We're taught that there's no class. America's a classless society because we don't analyze class that way. We think class is being able to consume things. You know.
Dear God. Well, but the way you describe it, it's a bigger mess than we think. I mean, we're going to get ourselves. I don't know. Maybe this country, maybe this global information, the media landscape, can walk and chew gum at the same time. Maybe we can fascinate ourselves and entertain ourselves with Paul. You know, with the troubles of Paula Deen and the Kardashians, and at the same time. Give a damn about the stuff that really is making a difference in and making a negative difference in the world that we're going to face. But I don't see evidence to suggest that. I see evidence to suggest the contrary.
Well, given you know freedom of choice in consumption of your media and your entertainment, yeah, of course, you know you'll consume what tastes good. I mean, I would rather eat a bowl of sugar than you know a bowl of broccoli. Actually, I probably wouldn't, but you know, I mean, that's the idea. The fact is, though, is that what we're doing is unsustainable. You know, it just is. Anybody with any sense of human cultural history will tell you that. You know, but it does seem like an inescapable problem, and I hate to be, you know, Johnny Downer or whatever, but it's you know, we're kind of it feels like we're running out of time to face this. We've had 250 years or so, you know, depending on where it starts, of experience with this economic system structuring everything else about our relationships and our politics. And, you know, 250 years into the experiment with pastoralism, humanity was doing fine. With foraging, we were doing fine. We did fine for 4 million years. But this is ugly.
Yeah, 250, the other coin is 250 years into our experiment with capitalism. And you know we're not at the end of human life on Earth, but we can kind of see it from here, can't we?
Well, it seems like it. It really does.
I mean, you know, we talk about what Charlie Pierce calls the giant death funnel into the United States. You know, the Keystone XL pipeline.
Yeah.
That really does have the end of life on human life on Earth, you know, kind of stamped on it. So too with fracking. So too with mountaintop removal. So too with what indigenous peoples are facing in places like Ecuador for gold mining, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
And then you know there's places like Nigeria, which you know the oil companies don't give a rat's rear end what kind of decay and degradation happens within those ancient cultures, as long as they get their money.
Right, because when we were convinced that we can't learn anything from these folks because they don't have big screen TVs and Lexuses, you know. So what do they have to teach us, aside from how to live without big screen TVs and Lexuses? But I don't know. I don't want to sound like a primitivist or like I'm romanticizing, you know, indigenous.
Well, but you know what? I think you inoculate yourself against that charge by simply acknowledging that does happen. No. You're the last guy in the world, Dr. John, that I would ever expect to haul out the noble savage argument.
Yeah, no, definitely. And we can go on about that. Well, I hate like hell because it sounds like I'm really, really depressed, and I'm not, because there's good work out there. And, you know, we need to hear from Preston or something because he always lifts my spirits. But I just wanted to throw out that impression of the Snowden thing.
Well, and you know, I was made aware of the concept of privilege a number of years ago, and I think I want to think this about myself, that I knew the meaning of the word without knowing the word and the connection to the meaning.
Yeah.
But it's very real, and now that I am aware of it, I see it all over the place. You know, how can you argue about, how can you look at what's going on in Texas, for instance, Dr. John, without just seeing the whole thing glowing in the dark with white privilege.
Oh, absolutely, and male privilege, and I guess to say, inspiring. I will say that the other side of what's going on in Texas is really just impressive to me. I mean, you know, Betsy is down there every day, and I just see the pictures with all those people of conscious, and that's good. That's what we need. You know, organization and community. That's the only thing that can stop this. And as long as we think of ourselves as these isolated individuals concerned with my metadata, you know, and my mail,
okay,
can
we stop there for a minute, Dr. John? Because I want to stop and just analyze this for a minute to make sure that I've got this straight.
Okay.
People are upset about a third-party corporation acting in behalf of the federal government, and that's a separate inquiry, and it just drives me crazy. And that's born of a libertarian impulse that says that the government can't do anything that the private sector can't do twice as poorly for twice as much money, and that's a good thing. Okay.
Right.
But you said, you know, people worried about their Facebooks and their Twitters. And at what point in time did people think that Facebook or Twitter or any other thing out there wasn't being logged? And at what point in time did they not look at the Internet and you know, I had no idea what the Internet, but I went on the Internet for the first time in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's late to the game. I don't know. But from that moment forward, there was an impulse to say, well, you know, this is going to be the great leveler. We're going to have freedom of speech just all over the place. And then before I knew it, you know, between, you know, AOL was the first one, and you know, Steve Case and that lot. But everybody was immediately beginning to try to work out a way to monetize the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's capitalism, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the way they were going to monetize the Internet was to gather data, because otherwise it's kind of, the Internet's not a, I mean, it's not a money-making scheme on its own. It has to be made to make money. You have to milk the cow. Am I still okay?
Okay, yeah.
And so, you know, the primitive, I think back to the primitive pop-up ads. And then the pop-up ad blockers come along. And then they come up with a better pop-up ad. You know, it's mice and mouse traps. And all this time, the whole thing is geared toward making money for somebody. I mean, I remember when Google was a baby and they were doing this the 60 Minutes expose on it, talking about how their motto was "Don't be evil." And I remember thinking back then, if your motto has to be "Don't be evil," then being evil is probably something that you're working on the fringes of.
It's in your neighborhood. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And so, this being a capitalist system, the next step is that once you've got a great big boatload of this data, you start looking for people to sell it to. Whether it's, I mean, look, I don't know about you, but I hate them, but you know what? I'll take their stupid card to get 69 cents off a can of soup at the grocery store.
Yeah.
Well, that's tied to me.
Right.
And that is my buying habits. You know, I like Manhattan clam chowder better than New England clam chowder by Campbell's, so my local grocery store will make sure that there's some Manhattan clam chowder on if I'm buying it with enough frequency.
Mm-hmm.
It's how you maintain inventory. And this stuff is swapped and sold. Everybody who's ever picked up a phone and answered a telemarketer's call, your metadata has been sold in order for that call to be made. And yeah, there were some lone voices out there crying in the wilderness about this stuff, but not to the extent that this was within the frame of this timing, and the timing and the frame has just set off. I mean, it's just got my spidey sense all tingly, John.
Well, it seems to be very focused on the government and not on the companies that are doing the collecting and selling.
Now,
I mean,
what political philosophy would do that, John?
Well, Right, and I mean I'm agreeing with you. I think is that's part of, you know, we're not taught to distrust the companies because they're job creators and they employ us. You know, most of us aren't employed by the government. Most of us don't realize the government is an enormous job creator. So that's the villain in this, and the internet's the same way. Is that we don't look at Google. We look at Google as part of the commons, but it is absolutely not part of the commons. Very clearly, the government is the commons, and smaller sort of, you know, voluntary social organizations are commons in a way. So we really misplaced, I think, the upsetness, the anger that's being directed towards the government. Yeah, the government does that, but of course that's what governments do, you know, and they've been doing it for a long time. I think that the anger should be at Google and Microsoft and these companies.
And the third-party defense contractors.
Oh, absolutely.
And the people who think that government can't do it right. Well, that's all libertarians. You know, like Snowden and Greenwald and Ron Paul.
Yeah.
And Rand Paul. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, it is.
But we're not going to frame it that way because the government is the idea, and I really want this to get home, Dr. John, the idea of government is what is under assault here. And based on what has gone before, you know, beginning with Reagan and forward, the idea that the public sector can the public sector can never do it right, and the private sector can always do it worse for more money, is ubiquitous now. We had ourselves a war in Iraq where a hamburger cost for a soldier cost. And this is outside of my general objection to the war in Iraq, but a hamburger for a soldier in Iraq cost $29 because Halliburton's profit margin had to be built into it.
Yeah.
Now, how many more the tens of thousands of human beings did we have in Europe during the Second World War when GIs were slogging along and bitching about the food in the chow line, but were, as Napoleon noted, marching quite capably and ably on their stomachs?
Mm-hmm.
Well, even with reduction to present value numbers, the hamburger or whatever, bologna sandwich even, or whatever rations were, the World War II soldier ate were of better quality and less money because the government was doing it all and there was not, and the profit motive was not smack dab in the middle of the process. It was off at the war materiel's end. That's where all the I mean, there was still profiteering.
Sure.
But it was at a sufficient distance that you didn't have Halliburton actually running the chow tents. You didn't have some independent contractor who had no obligation to mom or apple pie or flag or constitution refusing to deliver the mail. You didn't have independent contractors driving fuel semis between Basra and Ramadi. But this is all an outgrowth of that desire to frame government as the bad thing and the so-called private sector or the capitalist idea or the laughable free market as the solution. But what I fear in the framing of this story ultimately, Dr. John, is that this may very well constitute the final nail in the coffin of the commons.
Absolutely, because the, you know, government, at least in theory, is responsive to the commons. It's responsive to community. It's responsive to collective action. And that concept of collective action is absolutely anathema to capital, because we're taught that we have to be individuals in constant competition with everyone that is around us. We have to sever all personal ties because we are competing with other potential workers for access to market. We're individuals. And that is contrary to all of human history, contrary to our entire primate heritage, and it's contrary to sustainability and relationships and actual freedom. So I think you've got that exactly, and it's still, as I said, again, another example of something that reduces to the problem of capital and the economic system we have.
And so-called globalization is little more than lipstick on a pig for the expansion of brutal capitalism to every corner of the globe, wherein every corner of the globe and every human being living in every corner of the globe is finally, once and for all, put to work in the name of the boys on Wall Street.
Right, and we're all interchangeable. You know, we're all...
Right, a worker in China is the same as a worker in Kansas, is the same as a worker in Bangladesh, is the same as a worker in Guatemala.
Well, exactly. You know, the pilot that crashed that plane apparently had 40 hours of experience, you know, in 777s, but he's a pilot. He's interchangeable with a, you know, well-trained union pilot. You know, it's the same problem, and I hate to be so reductive about that, but it's an anti-human philosophy, and I think the sooner we get our heads around that, you know, the sooner we have a chance of actually digging out of this hole that we've gotten ourselves into.
Maybe that's the bottom line, what you just said. Maybe that's tonight's, I don't know, toaster of seriousness, Dr. John. Anti-human. Maybe that's the inquiry that needs to begin. Not anti-freedom or anti-property or anti-American or maybe the question that we need to be seeking answers for, or maybe the general rubric over everything that we analyze, is to what degree is this anti-human or pro-human?
Yeah.
Because pro-capital or anti-capital, as you said, has proved to be a 250-year disaster.
For most.
Well, yeah. And I think you can ultimately argue, you and I share the same skepticism over the Book of Myths, but, you know, there is a verse in the New Testament somewhere that says, "For what profiteth a man that he gain the whole world and lose his own soul?"
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can substitute in any number of words for soul there, Dr. John, and come up with a statement that's fairly profound.
Yeah, agreed.
And
I'm happy with freedom.
Right.
Yeah, I'm happy with freedom. I'd like to redefine what we mean by that. You know, because I think we need to get real serious about what actual freedom means. Not to be a good consumer, because that's a dead end.
No, and you know, all the studies prove that. Yeah, what was it? Denmark a couple of years ago was the happiest place on earth. You know, shockingly enough, not Disneyland, but Denmark.
Yeah.
Where the, you know, the television numbers were lower, the literacy rates were higher, and you know, quality time was higher.
Yep.
And yet, oddly enough, that is not, but, well, that Danish model is anathema to the money boys. You know, the Rolling Stones were touching on it. You know what, 1964, we can't get no satisfaction.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't smoke the same cigarettes as me. I can't get no satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, now I feel like I'm digging up chestnuts. But it's true.
Yeah, you know, this is fascinating, but very, 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 very wide-ranging. I enjoy it. I mean, I hope this made some sense and I don't come off as just some total pessimist or anything like that. But God, I mean, we gotta get some priorities here. This is an existential threat.
Yeah, it's, well, like I've said before, it's kind of what I occasionally either whisper or halfway holler at Ferg, yeah, or any of the other kids. Focus! Yeah. Focus, people, focus!
Yeah.
Dr. John, thank you so much for this conversation. I really appreciate it. It's kind of weird. It's kind of weird when the show gets short-circuited partway through, because it's kind of hard to find the thread of energy that you were on in the first place. And since I decided to go into the mailbag and answer Patrick's question, and I want Patrick to understand, I'm not being mean to him. It was clear from what he wrote that I had not made myself plain enough. I'm not saying that all this metadata business that the Supreme Court addressed was necessarily correct, but it is the law of the land. And, you know, that's a separate discussion about whether the Supreme Court should be the final arbiter of what the law of the land is. And if not the Supreme Court, who? And shall we call a constitutional convention? And to what degree will the Koch brothers make sure that they sponsor all the delegates?
Hmm.
But, you know.
Yeah, that's, That's terrifying. And no, I don't want to throw any shade on him either. I happen to disagree, and I hope that, you know, I could put some points forward that he would listen to. And I think he would, just from what he's written. I mean, I appreciate his comments. So, you know, that's all that.
The needs of the people matter. And the needs of the people are things like food, shelter, clean water, clean air. And, you know, maybe, you know, we're back, like you said, pro-human. What do pro-human people think humans need? What do humans need? And you start off with Maslow and work your way forward. And, you know, somewhere out a few billion light years, you may get to Lexus and big screen TV. But if Lexus and big screen TV are at the front end, you're doomed to failure, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you get that stuff sorted out, and you can get to work on stuff that really matters. You know, family, sex, music, art, dance. You know, the really good stuff that we like to think about.
Yeah, I know Texas Betsy will approve of my citation of this, but, you know, the Rabbi Hillel of the last century of before the Common Era and into the first century of the Common Era, they came to him and said, what is the greatest commandment? And he said, the greatest commandment is love. Is love your neighbor. Everything else is commentary. Now go and study.
Nice.
And it's true. It's true.
Very nice.
Dr. John, have a wonderful evening.
Thanks so much, Bob. I've enjoyed it.
I really appreciate your input. Bye now.
I appreciate it. Bye.
Dr. John, he says things much more clearly than I can. Hey, can we take a quick break? This just fits so doggone well. Listen up.
My friends, I still believe in ideals. I am not for a return to that definition of liberty under which for many years a free people were being gradually regimented into the service of the privileged few. I prefer, and I am sure you prefer, that broader definition of liberty under which we are moving forward to greater freedom, to greater security for the average man than he has ever known before in the history of America.
The latest news has struck me funny. Said you have no friends if you haven't got money, and all of us good folks in distress, but I'm gonna get something off of my chest. 1932 won't be long, and when you place your vote, please don't vote wrong. Vote away those blues, the breadline blues. Breadline blues. Now listen here, folks, and it ain't no joke. We've got to do something or we all gonna croak. We can't get a job, we've all been robbed. We've got no money and the corn's all cobbed. We've nothing but blues, the breadline blues.
snobbery calls, but snobbery doesn't mean a thing. It's just foregone death. Money is a thing we all sweat for. It's what some dreams are made of. But then there's those who want it all, and enough is never enough. It's a money disease. It's a thing called greed. And it feeds on those who need the money most in money land. Oh, it ain't so funny if you ain't got the money in money land.
Second, that's the Del McCurry Band and Friends. What you heard was actually an excerpt from a fireside chat from Franklin D. Roosevelt, and then the Breadline Blues of 1932 by Bernard Slim Smith, and that was the title track to their 2008 compilation, Moneyland, the Del McCurry Band. Yeah. Now, I haven't yet figured out how Barack Obama caused this to happen, but I'm sure he did. Because the story comes out of Melbourne, Australia. I can't say M-E-L-B-O-U-R-N-E. I tried one night with John Fox, like Australians say, because it looks like Melbourne to me, but it's apparently not. I think the L goes away. But anyway, it comes out of Melbourne, Australia. And apparently, this past weekend, the artist known as Pink was performing in concert there. And in a story published in a paper called The Age, it turns out that a 16-year-old got himself in some rather hot water. And you'll see why I'm bringing this story up. Pink has a song called Time Bomb. Okay, Agent Fred, this is a news story, all right? Let's see what Time Bomb is all about. I'm sure, as soon as the ad is over. Maybe not. Well, Dick, it's got a good beat, and you can dance to it.
True fear is contagious, infecting everything. It makes me do such stupid, stupid stuff. I say things I never mean. What exactly do I think? Who am I protecting? If I fall,
okay, so it's a relationship song, but what was that line? What was that line? That's kind of important. That actually runs with the theme, doesn't it?
It's right. I wish I hadn't started it. I hate when my fear speaks for me. It makes me nasty.
I hate when my fear speaks for me. It makes me nasty. And of course, in this country, our fear has made us nasty. From the force feeding of human beings that we had forever warehoused at our concentration camp in Guantanamo Bay, that's pretty nasty. To the right-wing paranoia and, you know, loading a shotgun in Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., that's pretty nasty. Yeah, so thanks, Pink. So that's Time Bomb. Okay? So in the story, in The Age, 16-year-old boy sent a tweet. He was standing there somewhere in Rod Laver Arena in Melbourne. And he tweeted the following. At Pink, I'm ready with my bomb. Time to blow up. Hashtag Rod Laver Arena, bitch. Okay. So apparently now, there are people who monitor Twitter at concerts because the world has caught our fear disease. And arena staff used the kid's photo from his Twitter profile to find him in a crowd of 12,000 people. They, meanwhile, had printed the photo off, or had simply printed the photo. I don't think we need off there. There's a little editor that lives inside me. I can't help it. Security people had printed his photo, came up, showed the photo to him. They found him out of 12,000 people, showed him the photo, and said, "Is this you?" And the kid said, I said, yeah, because it was my face. And suddenly they just turned me around and grabbed my hands and forced me out the back. So they get the kid out of the arena. And, well, they at least had the common decency to call his father. And Melbourne police offered to drop the charges against the boy when they realized he was not a terrorist. The father said, the policeman said to me, if it was up to me, I would have booted him in the backside and said, "Guy, I'm," but they demanded he be arrested. The they, in this case, being the arena officials, who are not to the best of my understanding, reading these stories, who are not elements of the government. A spokesman for the Melbourne and Olympic Park venue insisted that the matter had been handled appropriately, according to this David Edwards story at Raw Story. We can't risk not taking matters like this seriously. Our security staff acted to ensure the area was secure and handed the matter over to police. Notice, please, it was not the police who wanted to ring this kid up, who was rather inarticulately enthused about a song. It was the arena management. Can we draw a parallel? Bueller? Bueller? Right. There are people out there who don't give a good goddamn about your freedom. But mostly, they don't care about your freedom because what they care about is money. Because there are people who sit back and say, 12,000 people, well, if something disrupts that, well, goddamn, we'll have to give back, well, we'll have to rain check 12,000 tickets now, won't we? We can't have that. What will the quarterly profit and loss statement say? Honest to Pete. But, you know, that doesn't fit. That doesn't fit with the government is bad trope. Jane and Jerry asking, did the venue guys used to work for Blackwater? Well, or maybe they studied at a Blackwater Z seminar once upon a time. So, by the way, I had this note from Jan over the holiday, and I wanted to share it with you. Today, in your absence, another listener and I shared back and forth on Facebook. It was fun, it was educational, and it was sharing because you, my dear friend, brought us together across this land to find another moment in common. You mean so much more than our little bit we contribute each month. And I want you to know you're appreciated and needed. Don't let the bastards get you down. You're right on. And then this, one of the sweetest things I think I've ever read. Thanks to your family for sharing you with us. Thank you, Jan. Thank you very, very much. We often have a frank and open exchange here. And that's really great. But sometimes it's just a matter of being told, you know, just glad you're here. Because I'm so glad y'all are here. The things that Dr. John were talking about, the idea, you know, ideas of community and how it advanced human beings and ideas of human civilization and human culture more particularly. Well, that's a teeny... We're trying to do the same on a, I guess, micro scale, but macro globally. And I thank you all. Had the show not been interrupted for a considerable period of time this evening, there's a lot of other stuff to go to. I've got a couple more trips to the mailbag that I think deserve to be shared. I've got a brilliant note from Philip that's going to demand a whole lot more time than we have here. And then a note from our buddy Steve in New York City, formerly of Ohio. Subject line, update from Steve. Dear Bob, I wanted to update the Horn family on my job situation. I've landed a new gig, albeit temporarily, for a small practice in Lower Manhattan. The man I'll be working for represents employees suing employers for violations of state and federal discrimination laws. Honestly, it's where my heart is in the legal profession. I hope it somehow turns into something that's not temporary and becomes permanent. I'm sure we all do, Steve. So, I should be starting this week. Bob and Horn family, I won't kid you. The sitting at home is really beginning to take its toll. Again, it makes me so angry that anyone could think that a person could like this and collect that fat $400 a week. As much as I really try to not hate the rich and the right-wingers when I think of Louis Gohmert and all those people actually stating that people are out here living high on the hog on unemployment and welfare, etc., I just want to throw shit. My little New York apartment used to be my refuge. Now it's my prison. I've made up my mind that I will not allow the man who laid me off to get to me. I've made up my mind that I will not allow him to have that power over me. Yet, I will be honest with you. I have times when I become completely hopeless. Yes, feel free to read into that the worst kind of hopelessness. I don't think anybody has to read anything into anything, Steve, because there are a lot of people, whether you know it or not, and hopefully that there will be some comfort in the knowledge, who understand that hopelessness. And we are, every last one of us, rooting for you, Steve, because you're a part of this little community. And we know, we hope we know, that in a world that still has a modicum, even a mustard grain, not of faith but of justice, and a greater measure of mercy, that you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. So thanks to you all for being patient through this truncated broadcast. I appreciate it. And we'll get back at it tomorrow evening with Titanic Tuesday. Hopefully sooner or later this godforsaken upper respiratory thing will clear. My apologies for the pregnant cough pauses. Nasty. And we'll talk hopefully tomorrow evening. And a note, we started out needing to raise $300 this evening. We made it to $245. So thanks to Randy, and thanks to the no last name contributor. It is deeply appreciated. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Okay, quick correction before we're out of here. Robert in Australia. It's spelt Melbourne, the proper pronunciation being Melbourne, but most Australians just say Melbourne. Getting into a Pink concert in Melbourne. You have to get past probably a dozen or so police with drug sniffer dogs. You'll go through metal detectors and probably a bad search. Then you show your ticket. If you can get an explosive device through that, you're pretty good. Or the authorities are pretty paranoid. Pretty fearful. Thank you, Robert. And thank you, yes, to our all-volunteer staff. It is time to get out of here. Thanks to Lottie and Sparky and Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to Ben Birch, especially for his work getting things squared away this evening. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know. the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and ACHECT, ACHECT.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.